This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Now, I am so happy today. I have with me an author whose book it just blew me away. I have read a lot of thrillers lately and a lot of suspense books, and then I came across this one and I think it is just terrific. So I am so happy to welcome to the program Brad Parks. Brad, are you there?
Yeah, Patsy, it's great to be here. And after that introduction, I think maybe we should just end the segment right here.
No,
because I don't think it's going to get any better.
Oh, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. You're going to be blushing by the time we finish this interview, because I tell you, as I said, you know, I get a lot of books. all the publishers are sending me books, and I get them all, and I'm reading, and I read, you know, quickly. And sometimes if I don't like the book, I just stop. And then sometimes I get a book that I just cannot put down. And this book, I'm telling you, I was so thrilled with it, so impressed with it. And it is called Closer Than You Know. And it is your new book. And we're going to talk about some of your old books while I have you on, because I'm a great admirer of some of your old books. But I just have to tell my audience that you are the only author who has won the Seamus, Nero, and Lefty Awards, the most prestigious awards in crime fiction. And I can see why you did and why you will win many more, because this book is so good.
Yes, well, and now, yes, Patsy, you are also making me the only author who is beat red from embarrassment, but I appreciate it all the same. Thank you, Patsy.
Well, you know, it's funny when we, you know, I sort of, they sent me this little cover note, and I thought, oh, this is a subject I'm not going to like. I don't think I'm going to like it. And then I read the first chapter, and I tell you, you can write from a woman's point of view so beautifully. You beat everybody out. You're amazing. You're just amazing.
Thank you. You know, I was actually, I've never written from a woman's point of view before. It was the first time I had ever done this. For those who aren't familiar with the book yet, Closer Than You Know, the premise is this. A young woman, a working mother, comes home from work one day picking up her kid from childcare, only to learn the baby has been taken away by social services and no one will tell her why. And, you know, as I was thinking about setting a book in the world of social services and kind of having the, you know, because by the way, this is a real thing, Patsy. You know, I mean, no matter where you live, whether you're in Florida, whether you're in Virginia, where this book is set, it doesn't matter. There is an agency of government that has the authority to take your children from you. And, of course, the what-if that fuels this thriller is, what if somebody abused that authority? What if somebody found a way to manipulate the system? So as I was thinking about telling that story, it was clear to me that the most poignant perspective would be the mother. So suddenly, here I am. I'm hit for the first time with, oh, my goodness, I have to write from a women's perspective. And I was, frankly, a little intimidated until I actually started writing. And it was amazing to me how quickly, in most of the scenes, the fact that I was writing a female protagonist was about the ninth most important thing. You know, what was more important, Patsy, was the same questions I'd always asked of my male characters, which is, okay, what does this person want? What does this person need? What is getting in this person's way? What is driving this person? What is going to be success here? What's going to be failure here? You know, those kind of things. And it actually reminded me of a bumper sticker my buddy has, and that is, feminism is the radical notion that women are people. And that was really how I ended up approaching the female characters in this novel. They were just people who happened to be female. And so the, you know, gender really disappeared for me as the book went along.
And the main character, Melanie Barrick, she is just so well done. Now, we're talking about a young woman who herself had gone through family services, so she knew what it all meant. And so her insight into it as the story unfolds, and I will say, this is, I'll give you another compliment. This is like one of those bloomin' onions from, you know, from Outback Steakhouse. I mean, really, it's so beautiful. And you peel each one, and it's so good, and it's so tasty. And it just goes on and on. Just when you think, well, he's not going to have another twist to this story. He's not going to have another layer. Certainly, he can't come out with something else. You do. And it is. It's just like one of those beautiful Vidalia bloomin' onions.
I'm going to actually put that on the cover of the paperback, if that's okay, Patsy. Yeah. You know the blurb will be, this is like a bloomin' onion from Outback Steakhouse, comma, quote, Patsy. Here we go. Done.
You do it. I like it.
You know, and that was, frankly, a bit of serendipity. Of I knew I wanted to set this book in the world of social services, and it was actually my kid's babysitter one day, and I was coming home, I was trying to get some stuff set, and I overheard my daughter asking our babysitter, her name is Miss Nikita, she said, oh, Miss Nikita, do you have any brothers and sisters? And Nikita's answer was, oh, yes, I've had 20 or 30. And it was one of those moments where kind of like there's a little record scratch, and you're like, what is going on here? And, yeah, it turned out Nikita had grown up in foster care. And it was one of those moments where the light bulb just went on, and I said, oh, my goodness. What if I have this mother who I'm about to plunge into this nightmare with social services be herself a product of social services? And, you know, because she would then appreciate and know so much more than anyone else what she was about to be entered into. And, you know, the other thing I loved about Melanie and having that background is, so yes, Melanie was abandoned by her parents when she was 9 years old. She bounced from group home to foster care setting to group home. And, you know, anybody who knows the system knows that a nine-year-old is really, really tough to get adopted. You know, everybody wants the baby. And then there are a few of these great souls who will actually take in a teenager. But, man, that in-between is just, it is a really, really tough time for adoption. But Melanie is somehow able to overcome this because she is a survivor. And, you know, this is one of the topics that just really fascinates me, Patsy, is resilience. You know, why is it, I mean, what I put Melanie through before this novel even begins would frankly have me balled up in a corner whimpering in the fetal position. But Melanie not only survives it, she thrives. I mean, she comes out of this. She makes her way through college. She gets a scholarship to college. She now has a job. She now has a husband. She's got this little baby. Everything is going great in her life. And then, of course, she's plunged back in.
Yes, as she was once told, disaster is always closer than you know.
Exactly, exactly.
And boy, when you lay on the disasters, you lay on the disasters. It's just, it's so much fun. This book is so much fun. It's a horrific subject, and there's so much going on, and the way you've done it, every character is just beautifully done. And I'm thinking, well, he can't have done this purposely. Did he do this purposely? And as I said, it is this one succulent piece of this onion after another. Every character, I love all the characters and the way you write about them. And I will tell you, one of them, Amy Kay, who is the district attorney, is a marvelous character.
You know, and Amy is, she's a character I really enjoyed writing because she's the kind of person I've met. You know, but having been both a newspaper reporter and now also a crime fiction writer who really likes some verisimilitude in what he writes and what he does, I've spent a lot of time hanging out in courthouses. And you come across this character now and then, this person who is the prosecutor, who is really all about the law in the best way possible. And that is, you know, it's not the prosecutor who's about the wins and the losses. It's the prosecutor who really believes in the law and really wants to get a just result and understands the prosecution's role in getting a just result. And they're the most wonderful kind of person because they are so principled. And so really what I did was it took kind of some of those principled people I had bumped into during my time hanging out in courtrooms and put a lot of those morals and values in Amy Kay. And then kind of made the package a little tight, right, Patsy? Like, she was not the kind of character who's wearing her emotions on her sleeve. She's not going to tell you all the time what she's thinking and feeling because to her, it's not about her. Right, it's about the law, and she sees herself as a tool of the law. So, yeah, she is, and she's also very dogged and very persistent. One of the other storylines in this book is about this string of unsolved sexual assaults that she has been working on for years now, and she is just the kind of person who, man, once she gets her teeth into something, she is never going to let go.
And you weave all sorts of mystery in between. But when I got to her, and again, because you're writing from a woman's perspective, and you're writing about her so well, and I keep thinking as I'm reading, okay, there has to be another book with Amy Kay. You could do a series now just of Amy Kay because she's so fascinating. And you just brought in just enough about her husband so that we want to know a little bit more. We want to know more about her, and we want to see her, this dedication to the law and wanting to find the answers. I could see myself reading about Amy Kay for years to come.
Well, so I would love to actually pit Amy Kay against Bill Honeywell, who is, in this book, Melanie's lawyer. And Mr. Honeywell, so... we all have our favorite characters, right? And obviously, I became very attached to Melanie, and I loved Amy Kay, but I have to say my favorite character in this novel was Mr. Honeywell, in part because I had no expectation of him whatsoever. When I brought him on stage, it was like, okay, Melanie Barrick, my protagonist, is in a lot of trouble here. She has already been, somebody is trying to frame her for being a drug dealer. She has unwittingly or mistakenly assaulted a police officer, in addition to this social services case she has because there's been this anonymous tip that about her and her child. And so she is in a world of trouble, and she needs a lawyer, and I'm going to give her the saddest, lamest, most pathetic excuse for a lawyer possible, right? And so in walks Bill Honeywell, and he's got these big bulging eyes and the bags under his eyes and the fine spider veining in his nose. He seeks his knowledge in a bottle. And, his clothes are sloppy, and he's really just that ham and egg lawyer who's beaten down by life. And then as the
No.
I'm not allowed to say anything?
No, you're not allowed to say anything. No,
well,
don't go peeling that onion.
It comes as a delight and a surprise.
It does come as a delight and a surprise. And so many of the characters come as delights and surprises, because just when you think, okay, you're done with them or they're not important, they come back, and they come back so beautifully. Now, of course, as when I first thought it was going to be one of these really downer type of books, I thought, it wouldn't surprise me if she's dead at the end and the whole world collapses because, there is some, I get quite a few actually, it's amazing. I get some really, really deep down depressing books. So I was afraid when I started reading this, and then the delight I had as I'm going through this book and I'm more and more, revealing that, and I'm thinking, boy, when I finished it, I thought, wow, I don't know if you had all of these ideas in your head before you sat down to write, or if they sort of developed as you were writing.
No, I'm very much, you have a lot of writers on the show, so you've probably heard this phrase before, the plotters versus the pantsers. So, the plotters are the people who plan out everything, and the pantsers who go by the seat of their pants. I am very much a seat of the pants writer. And but I'm always looking for, well, two things. One, I love characters who surprise you, and I think I have a saying that readers love to be wrong. They love to think one thing and then turn out that something different happens. That's a basic, stock action in the thriller. So, and they particularly love to be wrong about characters. So that's one thing. And then two, I'm always fascinated by redemption, and by characters who are able to a certain extent heal themselves, fix those around them. And that's a theme that's probably in all of my novels. And I think is so that even when you make horrible things happen throughout, that there can be some ending that feels rewarding to the reader is very important.
And now, when you were writing, part of the fun of writing is when the characters do take over for you, and you're just going with them, and then suddenly you have to go one direction. You say, "Well, how I'm going to do it?" And the character sort of answers you, "Well, I'm going to do this," you know.
So, oh yeah.
That's fun.
And that's fun. And I will admit it. I'll sound like I'm crazy. I may need to be committed at the end of this radio program. But like, I talk to my characters. You know, they are, to me, they're these real people. I can close my eyes and I can see them. I can hear their voices in my head. And I will ask them, all right, what would you do in this situation? And it's so fascinating to me that oftentimes when I'm in the middle of the scene and it's not working for some reason, it's because I haven't listened to my characters. And it's because I'm making them do something they don't want to do and the scene isn't working. And as soon as I just tune in a little better, it all clicks in. And it's like, oh, well, of course, that's why the scene wasn't working. It's because I wasn't listening.
Well, you know, also, you make the reader feel like we're talking to the character, because I felt like I was talking to Melanie. I'm saying, okay, Melanie, do this. I've tried to, I have suggestions for her. And so you so engage the reader that it is absolutely delightful.
Well, the hope, of course, is that the reader, if you can make the problem universal enough, and I think in Melanie's case, I mean, the book begins with, she's lost her baby. And that can be, I think any parent can, of course, identify with that. But even if you're not a parent, you've lost the thing that matters most to you in the world, right? And that is universal enough that anybody can kind of put themselves in Melanie Barrick. And isn't that one of the rewarding aspects of fiction? When we feel like we are that character or we put ourselves in that situation, and then it becomes this just wonderful, immersive, sometimes scary, but ultimately rewarding experience of reading.
Well, you have done a marvelous job with this book. I really want to talk about, for a few minutes, because I don't have much about your other books, but I want to tell everyone that they have to get Closer Than You Know by Brad Parks, because it's a fabulous read. And it is a book that you will, all of you people out there, listen to me. It is just so much fun to read this book. And Brad, you've done a wonderful job. So I hope you're blushing, because I'm still going to talk a little bit. I have a little time to talk to you about your other book, well, your series based on Carter Ross, who is, I think, your alter ego, a reporter. And you have a series about him. So let's talk a little bit about Carter Ross. But I think I'm going to have you back on soon so we can talk about the whole series.
I would love to do that, Patsy. And I don't know what you mean by alter ego. Just because he's an investigative newspaper reporter for a newspaper in New Jersey, and I was an investigative reporter for a newspaper in New Jersey, and just because, you know, he has brown hair, blue eyes, about 6'1", 185, and I'm brown hair, blue eyes, about 6'1", 185. I have no idea what you're talking about, but I can possibly base this character on me, because the fact is, Patsy, Carter Ross is right-handed, and I'm left-handed.
Oh.
So, I mean, how could you possibly get us confused?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, he was looking in the mirror. I think he was looking in the mirror. Got confused that way. You know, one of the last of the books that I read, The Fraud,
right,
is another one. It is so perfect.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I won't dispute you, Patsy. I agree.
You know, I know the first book was called Faces of the Gone, right?
Correct. Yes.
And that was your first one, and it was coming along. But boy, by the time you got to The Fraud, this is an amazing book.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I always enjoy the time I spend with Carter, you know, because I don't know if I'm a big part of him or he's a big part of me. It gets a little confusing at times. But, you know, ultimately, he is another one of these guys who is, you know, driven by his own code. And his code is about journalism, right? And his code is about the search for truth. And Carter Ross is just old-fashioned enough to believe that there is this thing called the truth, and it exists, and his job as a journalist is to find it. And that's, I think, maybe something of an old-fashioned idea these days, but it's still a very, very important idea.
And he does it with wit and humor, which is so refreshing, because sometimes, as I said, I really am burned out with dark books. I put them off. I try to ignore them. I don't even want, if I don't want to be sort of in a dark place, I don't want other people to be there either. So that's why, like Carter Ross, it's fun. Their books are fun. I mean, you actually laugh out loud, and there aren't many books in the crime fiction genre that you're actually laughing out loud.
Well, and that was, not entirely intentional, but you know, when I was thinking about Carter, and I have read a lot of crime fiction, I love the genre, but I felt like there were probably too many, you know, ex-drunks with ex-wives with these horrible backstories. And, I mean, those are perfectly fine characters. I love reading those characters, but I don't necessarily hang out with a lot of people like that. I mean, yeah, we all have our baggage, but... you know, is that something we're all always dwelling in? And so, no, like, I like writing characters that I feel like I could bump into at the grocery store. And Carter Ross is definitely a guy you could bump into at the grocery store. He's just this ordinary, middle-aged white guy. You'll find him in the bread aisle. He's just a decent sort of guy. And I'd like to take a guy like that, this ordinary guy, and then put him in an extraordinary situation and see how he'll handle it.
And you certainly do put him in some extreme situations. But again, the entire series is fantastic. Are you working on another of those now?
There's another standalone coming next year. It is called The Last Act, or at least that's the tentative title. We'll see once it's done through editing if we stick with that title. But it is about an out of work actor who is hired by the FBI to impersonate a federal inmate in the process of which they hope he can help bring down a cartel. So it's going to be a lot of fun, Kathy, for sure.
Well, I'm looking forward to that one. I've got a sore throat today. We've had terrible weather here in Florida, too. All you people, I don't up north, you've had bad weather, but our weather goes off and on and off and on. But I am so happy that I was able to get through this interview so that I could talk to you because, again, I think your new book, Closer Than You Know, is fantastic. And I hope that people will get it, and I'm sure it'll be a bestseller. And do you have a website?
Yeah, my website is www.bradparksbooks.com. Or you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Brad Parks Books, or you can find me on Twitter at Brad_Parks. Or if you forget all of that and you can just remember my name, just type Brad Parks into Google and you'll be on your way.
Exactly. Okay, well, and they're going to be able to hear you back here on Joy on Paper soon because I'm going to contact you after the show and have you back next month, okay?
All right, sounds like a plan, Patsy.
Okay, great talking to you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Bye-bye, Brad.
Bye.
Wow. As I said, I love this book. I just love this book. Okay, we're going to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
My Pillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I'm just waiting to talk to two PhDs about a very, very important subject, beer. I mean, if you're going to have a PhD, why not have it in beer? And I'm just waiting to get them on the phone. I think they're going to be with me in a few minutes. So this is going to be fun, and this is just in time for St. Patrick's Day, because also I want to remind everyone that St. Patrick's Day is the anniversary of my third year here on Joy on Paper. And I want to thank all of you who have been sending me messages. And make sure that you go to my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and like me and send me some messages there about my third anniversary. And also go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can see the archive of my interviews and listen to some of your favorite authors. And now I have on the phone, oh, great, this is a wonderful thing for St. Patrick's Day, two authors who have, I think it's just fantastic that you have degrees in beer. Hi. Are you
Hi.
There?
Hi. Hello.
Okay, so I have with me Nancy Holst-Pullen and Mark Patterson, and you both have PhDs, and of course, you know, there are not many PhDs who have on their CV, oh, I drank thousands of bottles of beer.
That's true, 2,500 and counting.
Whoa. So, National Geographic's new book, The Atlas of Beer, A Globe-Trotting Journey Through the World of Beer, is quite amazing. And you guys, you really put a lot of work into this.
Yeah, in a two-year period, we went 160,000 miles to six continents, 28 countries, met about 400 or 500 people, and drank, like I said, a few thousand beers along the way.
Oh, boy. So did you do some of this? Were you jogging while you were going around to all these countries? Because that's a lot of beer to drink.
The Hash Harriers, yes, but otherwise, no.
Well, I think, you know, there are so many people. We could go to thousands of bars all over the world, and everyone would like to have a PhD in beer. But how did you guys get involved with beer? I mean, passionately involved.
We had written an academic textbook a number of years ago, and our publisher showed us a new book that was coming out called The Geography of Wine. And Nancy said, when are you going to do beer next? And we went out to lunch and sketched on the back of a cocktail napkin what the geography of beer would look like in terms of a book. And then they published the book a couple years later, and a friend of ours who works at National Geographic said, oh, come up to National Geographic and give us a presentation about what you think a coffee table book would look like. So we went up to Washington, D.C., and we gave our talk. And 2 years later, they published our book.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, give us a little bit of the history of beer, because it's been around a long time. For me, I love the smell of beer. And I've always thought that beer, as opposed to wine, beer is the real smell, really the perfume of the gods. You know, if I was a god, I'd want to smell like beer, because it's really nice.
It is actually linked to gods in Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt. The earliest known archaeological evidence shows that beer was being brewed in China, not necessarily using the recipes that we know nowadays. The closest thing to the brewing process that we do know, if we look at ancient times, would be in Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq. So from there, it migrated through to all the continents, apart from Australia, which had a much later date and only came about when the English sailed there with some convicts to have it become a new land for them to have under their commonwealth.
And the Australians have been making up for lost time for they're doing very well.
Oh, they sure have. And they make really great beer there, too.
Oh, they love their beer. I know I had quite a few employees who were Australian, and boy, they could put away that beer better than an Irishman.
Lots of practice.
Lots. Now, of course, it's... this book is coming out in time for St. Patrick's Day, because it is the subject when one talks about Ireland. Everyone talks about the beer. Tell us about your adventures in Ireland and beer.
So we liked Ireland so much that we had to go back a second time.
Yeah, I don't blame
one
you.
One of the things that we really enjoyed was visiting pubs. So pubs play a very important role in Irish culture. And it's not just a place to go have beer, but it's it was the pre-social media of the Irish culture, where people will gather to share news, talk politics, see what's coming around the corner, what the latest events are. So in that sense, you find the pubs being a very important place in Irish culture. You've got a country of 5 million people with over 7,000 pubs. And if you do the math, you'd find that's one of the highest ratios of pubs to people you'd find in the world.
Well, I lived in England for quite a few years, and our biggest, what we had in this little village where I lived were 3 pubs, of course, and that's where we networked. That's where we didn't need all the other social media, because that was our social media. We headed, you know, in those days when I lived there, the pubs were still closed during midday, and everybody'd wait until 5 o'clock when they opened back up, and we'd be sitting there waiting for the pub to open, and that was a wonderful, wonderful time to get to know people.
Yes, we've been to parts of Ireland that have something called an early house, and I'll have Mark talk about that.
These are places that open up early in the morning, and they're geared toward, by early in the morning, we're talking like 6 a.m. And they're geared toward people who are finishing off their evening and want to have one last drink, or people whose jobs start early, so people who work in the fish markets or the flower markets. And for them, 6 p.m. or 6 a.m. would be their lunch break, so they could go into these early houses and have a pint of beer. And you meet just the most interesting characters there.
Well, of course, in the old days, and I know that in England, people drank beer partly for health reasons, because the water wasn't very good. And so even young people, children drank beer.
Absolutely. And that wasn't just in England. That was also in the U.S. too. It was quite common in the early America for people to prefer beer over other forms of drink. So you have everyone from children to the elderly drinking. In fact, it was so important that the first advertisement for a job from the U.S. was to look for a brewer. So beer has always been an important part of not only Europe, but also in the U.S. themselves.
Now, when we're talking about beer, what is the essential ingredients to make it call, we call it beer?
There's four main ingredients to make beer. It's the water, which can vary depending on where you are. You've got the grains, which can be normally barley, but you can include rye, sorghum, oats, wheat. You've got yeast, which is the important part that makes the carbonation and the fermentation. So that's the magical part of making beer. And, of course, the hops that can give it the bittering and acts also as a preservative. So those four things are the main ingredients in making beer. But any more, people add all sorts of adjuncts, different things. Things from tea, flour, aging it in wine barrels, you name it, and they can add it to make beers really eclectic, eccentric, and unique.
And some people even add chocolate.
Right.
And is that's one of your favorites, Nancy?
The last batch of beer that I brewed was a chocolate stout, so I added chocolate into the brewing process.
Okay, I haven't tried that yet, but it sounds good. And you also make your own beer, right?
Yes, we're both home brewers.
And what's your favorite type of beer to brew? What do you like?
I prefer making a goza, which is a historic style that's coming back into popularity. Some people love it, some people hate it, but it's a wheat-based beer, originally from Germany, that's pretty tart, little sweet, and I added passion fruit to it to give it just a little bit off its salty edge that it's known for.
Wow, that sounds good.
I'm not as daring as Nancy. I think my go-to home brew would just be an American pale ale.
Now,
something that's good for the summer.
Now, do you like cold beers? Do you like your beer cold?
Some of the best beers shouldn't be served really ice cold. If you have a lager, you'd probably want a cold beer. But the higher the alcohol, usually the warmer you'll serve it. So many times you'll have a beer that may be very heavy in taste or a high alcohol, and having it super cold is not the best way to actually drink it. You'll want to warm it up. A lot of times you'll warm it up with your hands in the glass itself, and you'll get more of those nuances of flavors and tastes that you wouldn't be able to have and you wouldn't be able to taste if it was too cold.
Mostly Americans drink their beer cold, don't they? Most.
They do, yes.
As compared, I know in England when I was there, they would laugh at an American when Americans would come in and want a cold beer because they didn't have cold beer. It was a small pub and they had their traditional, you know, methods. So It's quite different here, I think, than for example, how do the Japanese drink their beer? Do they like it cold?
Actually, the Japanese like their beer cold, and one of the reasons is it has to do with taxes and the amount of barley that they use in their beer. That the more barley they use in beer, the higher the taxes. And typically, when you have a beer that does not have much barley, which is what you find in Japan, you want to serve it cold. So to answer your question, yes, Japanese prefer their beer colder.
So who's the biggest consumer of beer?
Oh, that's by far and away China. In fact, the number one beer in the world in terms of production, the amount that they make, it's called Snow. It's owned by AB InBev, the same ones that make Budweiser. And they make more Snow than any other beer in the world, and yet you can't get it outside of China.
But you went to China to get it.
You have to, yes.
And so
on a per capita basis, the biggest drinkers are the Czechs. So they have about 175 liters per person each year, which is far greater than other beer nations such as Germany, Austria, Belgium.
So you went to China to drink snow?
We did.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I mean, talk about a perfect life to be able to travel to all these places just to drink beer and to be paid for it. It's wonderful, isn't it?
You know, somebody had to do it, so we figured why not us?
Yeah, I know. So what does snow taste like? What would you compare it to? Now everybody's going to want snow.
It's like water.
Carbonated.
Carbonated water.
There's really not a lot of taste to it. But I can see why it is well-liked. It's relatively low in alcohol. It's cheap. And it pairs well with Chinese dishes, no matter what the region that it comes from.
So when you were... What's the strangest place that you traveled to check out the beer?
Strangest? That's a really good question.
You know, there wasn't a place that we went to where we did not have a absolutely fabulous time. So that question's kind of thrown us for a loop.
I would say that it was interesting when we got stranded in Soweto, which is just outside Johannesburg in South Africa. And we got to spend a couple hours there drinking beer with locals. We got to see Mandela's house, so that was kind of neat.
Oh, that's neat.
But it's always interesting when you get to go to a place and you have success in getting there and then realize you're not really quite sure how you're going to get out of there anytime soon.
But you had fun meeting other beer makers, people who have the same enthusiasm as you do for beer.
Absolutely. And you'll meet them anywhere, men, women, old, young. You'll find there is really no classification of what constitutes a beer lover. And that's really the great part, is that you never know exactly who you're going to get when you talk to them. And you don't know what language they'll speak or how well they'll speak it, but in the end, you always have something that you both can agree on and both talk about and enjoy.
When you were when you were in South America, which countries did you go to there? Most of them?
We traveled to Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay.
Because there was some kind of beer from Peru I tasted once. It was quite unusual.
Was it chicha?
Maybe that's it. Why was that? What was unusual about it? I remember it was unusual.
Well, that's the indigenous beer to South America, predominantly found in places where you find the Incas. So Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia.
So were they making beer before?
They were making beer before the Europeans came over, and they were making it out of corn. And how they would do it is, and this was typically the women, is that they would chew the corn until it became a mash, and then they would spit it out, and they would collect buckets of this chewed-up corn and saliva and leave that exposed to the air, and the natural yeast in the air would land in it, and it would ferment it. And then after it was fermented, they would drink it.
Okay. I hope that's not what they served me. I remember somebody served me some beer, they said, from Peru, and I thought, that has strange taste. But, okay, I hope they didn't make it the old-fashioned way. I hope they didn't make it the old-fashioned way. That's funny. That must have been a nice trip to Peru, right?
Absolutely.
When you go around traveling and you're saying, I'm here for the beer, do people think, boy, this is a strange occupation?
Well, I would say our second most common question is, do you need any help?
And I'm sure everybody is willing to do that. Now, why are the Irish so well-known for beer? Is there something special about Irish beer?
I don't think it's so much the beer itself as it is the function that the local pub plays in the culture.
When it comes to beer itself, the Irish stout, the dry Irish stout that they're known for now, this would be a Guinness, Beamish, Murphy's, that have the style. It actually originated from England, or a variation of it did. So those porters and stouts were popular in England, but it was so popular it was being imported from England. And so Alex Guinness thought, well, that's ridiculous. Why are we importing it when we can't just make it ourselves? And so he made his own variation of it, which has now become what we know as Guinness. And they have different types of stouts, not just that. There's also the foreign stout. There's tropical stouts. There's stouts all over the place. And, in fact, porters, which is more or less the same as stouts, not the same, but from the same kind of family of it, is the first global beer that ever came about. So it's the first one that made it all over the world.
Now, this book is lovely. The cover is really special. So, specifically, were you involved with the selecting the photos, or just the writing of the book?
No, we had to provide many of the photos you find in the books. Obviously, some of the older photos aren't ones that we've taken, but fortunately, National Geographic has a huge archive of photos around the world that we were able to use in the book. Most of our work, our contributions to the work, were the actual writing. So we would go ahead and write up a chapter on a particular country, and then a layout editor would take our text and then drop it into the appropriate places.
But I will say that we came in knowing what we wanted, and it was really National Geographic who helped create the end product, and it's better than what we even originally conceived.
Because they have over 200 beautiful color photos and the maps that are gorgeous.
Yes. Well, you can't do geography if you don't have a map.
That's it. And I think that many people will really enjoy traveling the world. Like you, as a matter of fact, you could probably now start tours. You know, you could have a whole new career shuttling people all over and making a fortune taking people around on beer tours, because everyone wants, once they read this book, they'll want to have the opportunity to go and to the places, because you make it all, it's all sounds exciting and looks interesting. And certainly you are the people to tell everyone about beer.
Well, thank you so much. If it ever comes to fruition, you're the first one on our list.
Oh, I will. I would be happy to be on this tour, because I think you've managed to put together here a book that is informative, because after all, you are PhDs, and we need to get educated, right? We always want to get educated, and if there's any subject that people will enjoy getting educated about, it is beer. So I want to thank you both for being on the program today, and I just want to mention your names again so people will remember you: Nancy Holtz-Pullen and Mark W. Patterson. And the name of the book is Atlas of Beer, and A Globetrotting Journey Through the World of Beer. And I think that you guys have done a terrific job in putting this book together.
Thank you, Patsy.
Thank you.
Okay. So, again, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today. And everybody, when you are out there drinking your beer on St. Patrick's Day, think about getting this book.
Cheers.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye. Oh, my sore throat. I need a beer. Maybe that'll help. I don't know. Is beer good for sore throats? Hey, Ed in there. Is beer good for sore throats? You don't know? Ed doesn't know. Okay, well, let me just say, do we have a book buzz there to play? Let's play one book buzz before we go, and then I'll be right back. I want to talk about the Writer's Digest contest. We'll be right back.
Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz. And an innocent night of fun takes a shocking turn in Not That I Could Tell, the next page turner from Jessica Strasser. Here's the buzz. When a group of neighborhood women gather, wine in hand, around a fire pit where their backyards meet one Saturday night, most of them are just ecstatic to have discovered that their baby momager's reached that far. It's a rare kid-free night, and they're giddy with it. They drink too much, and the conversation turns personal, and by Monday morning, one of them is gone. Everyone knows something about everyone else in the quirky small Ohio town of Yellow Springs, but no one can make sense of the disappearance. As the police investigation goes from a media circus to a cold case, the neighbors are forced to re-examine what's going on behind their own closed doors and to ask how well anyone really knows anyone else. In Not That I Could Tell by Jessica Strasser, the author tackles the secrets of suburbia, domestic abuse, and friendship in a gripping story about a neighboring family gone missing. Due out March 27th, readers will find the characters unique, engaging, and relatable, and the ending both surprising and poignant. Hey, this is Rita Moreau, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more on my suggestions on mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's Radio-Joy on Paper. This is Rita Moreau, reporting for Joy on Paper, buzzing off for now.
Okay, thank you, Rita. Now, I just wanted to remind everyone, the Writer's Digest Indie Book Award contest is coming up. The deadline is April 2nd. If you have published a book, it's an indie published book, you can submit it to the contest. It is a wonderful contest. If you win this, you are a very, very happy person, because a few weeks ago I had Nancy Peacock on. She had published her book in 2013, and it didn't go anywhere. But in 2017, 4 years later, she won the Indie Book Award contest, and boy, oh boy, did she get a publishing deal. And that's exactly what can happen to you. Now, you might not even win first prize, although first prize is great because it's $8,000 and a trip to New York, but still try to get at least placed, and it will help you get a real contract with one of the major publishers. So make sure that you take some time and submit your book, and meanwhile keep writing, because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or maybe even in a film. So keep writing, and meanwhile make sure that you say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And also, everybody have a very, very happy and safe St. Patrick's Day this weekend. Okay, bye bye for now.